Hi, today is February 1st, 2014, and this is Mobile Views Podcast number 73, Bye Bye Nexus. Today, I've got my friend John Westfall with me. This is Todd Ogasawara. We've got a couple of things. The big news this week was a surprise to me, at least, and it's that Google sold Motorola Mobile, or at least a chunk of it, the part that manufactures phones, to Lenovo in China. Were you surprised, John? I was.
I was surprised just because they had only held on to Motorola Mobility for, I think, about 19 months was Larry Page put in the blog post. It makes a lot of sense to flip it if that's not where you want to go. And I think 19 months ago, we were very confused if Google really did want to go in the produced device market or if they just wanted the intellectual property. So it looks like all of our are they really serious questioning was somewhat accurate. They wanted the intellectual property and not too crazy about producing a bunch of phones.
Right. And they did. Some people made a big deal about the price they bought it at versus the price they sold it at. But there's actually a little bit of explanation for that, right? So I think they bought it for $12.5 billion. That's billion with a B. And they sold it for something like, was it $3 billion, $2.9 billion, something like that. But they did sell off the set-top box part of Motorola Mobility. They also are keeping some but not all of the patents. And I think they get a little bit of a tax write-off because of losses. Maybe it's not they're not selling it for a profit, I don't think, but I think it's a wash, more or less.
I think they're breaking even, and I think they've done some things with Motorola Mobility that if Lenovo keeps up with were positive changes for that division. So they drastically cut down the number of handsets that Motorola was producing to focus on handsets that people actually want versus 100 handsets that people probably could take or leave. So I think if Lenovo keeps up with that, it'll be a positive move to have this slight detour into Google land for Motorola and Motorola fans.
Yeah, it'll be interesting with Lenovo. Lenovo bought IBM's ThinkPad division, and I guess their desktop division too, a number of years ago, and they seem to have done fairly well with that. Although I think a lot of people prior to the NSA brouhaha were kind of worried about mainland China-based companies implanting some kind of spyware or something right at the hardware level. Certainly think Huawei and a few other people are not entering the U.S. market because of those issues. And it'll be interesting to see if somebody makes a stink about Motorola Mobility. But nobody has said anything about the Lenovo ThinkPad, which I believe is still enormously popular and well-regarded.
It is, and I think part of that is because when they bought the ThinkPad brand, they decided to keep IBM service for the ThinkPads. So if you still send off your ThinkPad because it breaks, it still goes to IBM. It's just Lenovo owns the brand. So I think that was a good way to keep corporate customers pretty happy because that was the big draw. I know, at least for me when I was using ThinkPads, was that if it broke, I wasn't waiting a week or 2 weeks. Well, usually I wasn't waiting a week or 2 weeks like I was with Compaq or HP for a replacement. I was getting, you know, a box the same day. It was going out, and then the next day it was fixing, and then the next day it was back in my hands. So that was, I think, the big selling point for Lenovo keeping IBM service was, hey, we just own it now, but it still looks the same. It still gets serviced the same. It's still, you know, solid hardware, et cetera.
Yeah. So we'll have to look forward. The deal will probably take a little while to close. So we probably won't see anything this year in the pipeline from the Lenovo-owned Motorola Mobility. But it'll be interesting to see what they do with the brand, which I think still has some value as simply a name, at least in the U.S., and what they do with the actual products. I think the Motorola, the Moto X and Moto G were relatively well received. But one of the things that's been missing from Motorola's lineup was their tablet. They came out with, I think, the first Android tablet, which was the Zoom, X-O-O-M. It was gigantic and a little bit clunky, but interesting, and nothing since then, I think. Or if it came out, I just didn't notice.
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't think we've seen any other tablets. And I know the Zoom came out right about the same time the first Galaxy Tab came out. Because I bought one of the first Galaxy Tabs, which is now a digital picture frame in my living room. That's how that's been repurposed over the years. So you're right. After the Zoom, not much in terms of tablets.
No, not at all. Now, the other thing that was not announced by Google, but I read as a rumor, I guess, in BGR.com, the Boy Genius Report, is that Google plans to discontinue the Nexus brand, which, if true, is a huge disappointment to me, because really, the only Android phones I've bought, well, I bought the Droid, and that was, you know, which I thought was the first really good Android phone. I also bought the G1, but I returned it because that was terrible.
Then I still have a G1 in a box over here somewhere, actually.
And I bought the Nexus One, which was good for its time, but was never upgraded beyond Gingerbread. So and very limited memory, so I can't even upgrade apps on it anymore. And currently, I use a Nexus 4, you know, which is now one generation behind, but still a very good phone. And if it's true that, and I also have a Nexus 7, the first generation Nexus 7, so I'm a pretty big Nexus fan, and I'm going to be very disappointed if Google gets rid of the unlocked phones and their low cost tablets. Although other brands like Samsung produces Android tablets at a fairly low cost these days. Your thoughts? Do you think that's going to happen?
Well, like you, I was a pretty big Nexus fan. I had the Nexus 1, the Nexus S, the Nexus Galaxy, and the original Nexus 7 tablet. I actually ducked out around the Nexus 4 era and the Nexus 5. But I really did enjoy the fact that they were giving us hardware that was getting the first release candidate, you know, software. They were able to update that fairly quickly, although that was always a source of contention, I know, for the OEMs, the fact that when Google would announce a new version of Android, that was the same day that the OEMs would actually get the copy of the software to start customizing it for their devices. Right. So, you know, in a sense, the Nexus line had an unfair advantage that we might, without it in the marketplace, not knock other OEMs' devices so heavily because they're, you know, everyone will be lagged in updating.
Right. The other thing I really liked, or I really like, I should say, current tense, I really like about the Nexus line, and it's not a single manufacturer, is that they don't have all the gunky UI add-ons. There's no UI Sense, there's no HTC Sense, or whatever it's called, there's no LG candy-colored icons. It's the pure Google experience. Now, you can buy phones that are Google experience, but they're oddly lacking in a way, I think. For example, I think if you buy the HTC One Google Experience, you don't get all the camera bits because that's a HTC property. And so you get this nice phone, but without the camera bits, it makes it really nice, I think. But then you have to have HTC's terrible UI, when I'm sure HTC doesn't agree with me at this point, but I don't like add-on UIs.
No, I love this idea that somewhere in HTC someone's going, yes, we have this terrible UI that we are pushing on everyone. It's a diabolical scheme of some sort. Yeah, and you're right. To get the perfect picture, at least out of the box, I think the Nexus line gives the best experience, although those who are into the hacking ecosystem and aren't unhappy with changing ROMs and you know, violating a few intellectual property rights here and there to cut and paste things into ROMs, they've had all the good bits and everything else for a long time now. So, unfortunately, for the OEMs, that might be a side effect. If the Nexus line goes away, all the Nexus users, instead of going to stock OEM, will start going into the ROM community and creating probably more problems for the OEMs than they had anticipated.
Right, getting their XDA developer unofficial upgrades, and yes, so to speak.
Unofficial is the kind word for it. OEMs, especially the lawyers at OEMs, would have more harsh terms for these wonderful little amalgamations of open source and proprietary code.
Okay. Now, I know you've got a trio of mini reviews this week that I'm anxious to hear. But before we do that, I want to talk about something we spoke about earlier, and that is last year, 2013, near the end of the year, I bought a Dell Venue 8 Pro, which is Dell's 8-inch Windows 8, a real Windows 8, not RT, tablet that I happen to like a lot, said so on this podcast. One thing I didn't buy when I bought my tablet, however, was Dell's Active Stylus. And you have to buy Dell's Active Stylus. You can't replace it with a Wacom or Wacom or something else. I think they use Synaptics or somebody like that for their stylus. And for some reason, a couple of weeks ago at least, when I finally decided I would really like a stylus for my Venue 8 Pro, it disappeared from Dell's website. It still disappeared. It's gone. If you go to their website, you see a picture of it in Dell Venue 8 Pro product page, but there's no description of it in a list of accessories. There's no way to buy it. There's practically no mention of it except in the support community, in the support bulletin board system over on Dell.com, that where people are complaining about the fact that it's not on the website. Excuse me. So this morning I tweeted Dell Cares, and they were kind enough to answer. And they say, as of today, February 1st, 2014, the product is on engineering hold. It should be available within a month. So, well, we'll see if sometime in March it appears. But I hope it does, because one of the things I've learned about an 8-inch Windows tablet versus, say, an Android or iOS device, an iPad, it really needs a stylus. And it's a problem that is not apparent in the 10-inch Windows tablets. But when you get down to 8 inches, it becomes hard, especially in a desktop, to hit basically things that weren't designed for a touchscreen to begin with and now are really tiny on an 8-inch screen. So I've been using a capacitive stylus for my iPad with my Venue 8 Pro. And that's okay, but it's not ideal, and I hope an active stylus gives me a better experience. And of course, one of the reasons it's on hold is because there are so many complaints, both in terms of durability. People are complaining it was dying within, you know, a week of use or breaking. And of course, they were having a lot of problems with the underlying driver, it appears, in terms of the actual experience if you did have a working stylus. So hopefully those things are being addressed. I know there have been a couple updates to the driver itself, and people seem to be happier in the last month or so. And if I get one, I'll provide them in your review. Now, onto your review. So you've got three items. That's the first thing you're going to talk about.
I do, and on the stylus note, at some point I should talk about the Adonit Jot stylus that is the Evernote edition that I've been playing with for a few months. So another thing for another day, but I do agree that styluses are still a present force in the mobile device ecosystem, and it'd be nice to see Dell get back on top of it and get that stylus available. So moving on to the mini reviews I have, the first device that I'd hoped to talk about this week was the Loop Fob. This is available at looppay.com, so it's the double looppay.com. Loop is this interesting little startup that was Kickstarter funded last year. They've got this thing called the Fob that has a magnetic induction capability to it, so it can actually simulate the same magnetic signal that your credit card gives off to a credit card reader. So they've got these wonderful little videos of people taking the fob and putting it up against the credit card reader and hitting a button, and boom, the credit card reader goes, oh, you know, processing and then approved or whatever. And the back of the fob has a reader for you to swipe your credit cards in. And so the goal here is that your whole wallet can live on your phone, and you just have this accessory that you can magically beam your credit card information to. They say 90% of point-of-sale terminals that are available today, so a pretty good saturation at launch. And I really hope to play with it this week, except the app is still under review by Apple, and so it has not made it into the App Store yet. So it's tempting all of us who have the fob accessory. I'm looking at it, but I can't play with it until I get the software bits. And people have kind of tried to rally Loop, saying, well, maybe, you know, for people who are jailbroken, could you provide an unofficial download? But that's probably not in their best interest. Or it's probably not even in the best interest of the community to have software that might not exactly be up to snuff. So hopefully in this next week, they'll get that out and I'll be able to talk more about it.
Do you have a guess as to why Apple's holding back on the app? Do you think it's a purely a functional thing, or do you think it's something because it competes with Passbook or something like that?
My guess is actually it was more a logistics timing issue with Loop. They, I think the development of the software ran a little bit slower than they were hoping, because when they announced that they had just submitted it to review process, that was, I think, 2 days before I got the hardware. So I think they had hoped to submit it earlier, and just things had slipped internally for them. And as someone who's gone through the App Store review process, you can be sitting in line for a week or more, depending on what, you know, your app does or how long it will take for them to test your app out. In this case, Apple might want the actual hardware. Sometimes they get a little bit annoyed if it's requiring hardware because they can't fully test out the functionality. I sort of doubt that, but it wouldn't be the strangest thing I've heard. So I don't think it's necessarily held up on Apple's end. I think it was late getting to the party on Loop's end.
Okay, so we're going to table the mini review of the Loop Fob payment accessory.
Okay.
Okay.
The second thing that I've been playing with is this device called the Automatic. It is a device that purports to tell you how your driving is and how to better drive so that your fuel economy and your car are able to, your fuel economy goes up and your car is able to stay on the road longer because you're a better driver and not destroying it. This little thing plugs into the OBD2 port that is found on all cars sold in the U.S. after 1996. So it's got pretty widespread penetration. It takes only about, it's about $99 to buy. So you buy it, you hook it up, and you pair it to your smartphone. And you get wonderful little stats, like you get a driving score each week. So my score this week was a 97 out of 100, so I guess I'm driving appropriately.
Wow.
And it dings you for three things principally. Hard braking, so sudden stops. Driving over 70 miles per hour, which I haven't been on the highway lately, so that's probably why my score has been so nice. And hard acceleration. And it also calculates for each trip. So if you have, for example, a hard acceleration, it will tell you where it was on the trip. So on a little map, it shows here's where you floored it. And it also calculates how much money you're spending for each trip and the fuel economy. So I know that yesterday night, for example, I drove 8.1 miles. I got 20 miles per gallon. And it cost me $1.28 to come back from the gathering I was at last night with friends.
So how easy is it to install? You said you plug it in. I assume you unplug something on your car and you plug it in. You plug the other end back in. And do you need any special tools? Any special knowledge aside from where the OBD2 port is?
It's actually simpler than even that. So these OBD2 ports, if you've never looked at the one on your car, they're open ports that are either under the steering wheel or in some cases they're in the passenger side of the compartment. Mm-hmm. So you kind of have to dig around, feel under steering wheel or under the paneling, and you find it because they have to be available for state inspection. So this is the same port that state inspection devices will connect into. Or if you take your car up to a mechanic and you're getting a check engine light, which incidentally is another thing that the Automatic will do. If you have a check engine light, it'll tell you what code your check engine light is saying. So it's really just locating that and plugging this in. It takes about, once you find the port, it takes less than a minute to get it in. It gets power off of the car accessory, so the Bluetooth becomes available. You find it on your phone, and under optimal conditions, it takes about 2 minutes to get set up and running.
Do you have to take it off when you take your car in for a safety check, for example?
You would, which again is just you pull it right off, so it's like any other thing you connect to a port. I assume that the safety check people probably haven't seen too many of these, but they'll, you know, it comes off rather easily. There's no hardware you need to screw in or unscrew or any kind of real clip or anything like that. It's just pull it straight off or push it straight on.
Okay, so that's the Automatic for, you said, about $99?
Yep, $99, and you can track your driving, get your score, and also check engine. And they also are talking about what they're calling Crash Alert Beta, which would be a bit of a crossover to the idea of the OnStar. You know, as soon as it detects something bad happens, signing up for this would then say, okay, if the Automatic sees something weird happen, you'll then get a call from our call center, and we can see if you're okay or if we need to call someone to help you out.
Nice. You know, I was just thinking, my daughter just got her license recently, and it would have been kind of neat to have that on the car when she was learning to drive, to score her and see the improvement as she, you know, from literally from day one behind the wheel to the day she got her license. But in any case, yeah, that would be kind of interesting. And I also want to note that I don't think it has all of these features, but I know some of the hybrids. My wife drives a hybrid car. It does do some scoring, but I don't know what factors it involves in scoring your driving. I think mostly it's the aspects of driving that are related to fuel efficiency, because as you know, the hybrid still has, you know, when you use fuel, when you switch to electricity. But in any case,
so the hard stops and the rapid accels would probably be the two things that they would look for.
Exactly.
And I did notice that the so there are times when you get dinged, even though you're being a good driver. You know, a light changes suddenly on a road that's 55 miles per hour. You can't. There's not much you can do about that. You have to kind of stop suddenly. And then also, I was going down a hill, and it dinged me for a rapid acceleration because it's looking at the miles per hour. It's not looking at load on the engine. So
right. If
you go downhill, it will yell at you, even though you're doing something that's great. It's great for fuel efficiency because, you know.
Now, does it provide real-time information on your phone? Like, you know, if you have your phone mounted, for example, on your dashboard, or is it something you look at after you're done?
It's something you look at after, although it does have a built-in little mini speaker that will play three different tones for the three things that it dings you on. So as you're driving, you'll hear this little beeping noise if you accelerate too fast or if you stop suddenly, etc.
Okay, I might.
And then you immediately, you immediately go, ah, dang! Now I got dinged on my score for this week.
Yeah. It does give you feedback, so that's good. And what's your third item?
So the third item is what I guess I've been calling the Cadillac of health trackers. It's something called the 2014 Carbon Fiber Basis Band. It's a health tracker, much in the same vein as the Fitbit line of products or the Fuel Bands or the Jawbone Ups. But it costs a little bit more. It's $200. And it includes a number of sensors that the others don't have. So, for example, it can track your resting heartbeat. It also will track skin conductance and skin temperature. It also tracks your sleep. So if you wear it at night, it will give you these nice little graphs that talk about how long you've spent in deep sleep versus light sleep versus REM sleep. In general, their goal is much more goal-oriented or habit-forming than most of the other devices. So you're trying to every week kind of level up your goals to get better recognition on their website.
And I know you've been playing with other things, and you've written an article on your website comparing it to the Fitbit 4. So you have a teaser for people to go find your article and maybe a word or two about what you're comparing the two?
Sure. Well, the review is right now the most recent thing on johnwestfall.com. It's just johnwestfall.com. And I was curious basically to find out which was more accurate. And anecdotally, it appears that the Basis is a little more conservative from the actual state of the world, and the Fitbit Force is a little more optimistic. So if I count out a number of steps, the Fitbit will be a little higher than what I count, and the Basis will be a little lower. The Basis also gives me a little bit more detailed information that the Fitbit doesn't, for example, during the sleep tracking and such. So my goal, you know, at the end, I won't ruin it. I have comparisons for the same day. I wore one on one wrist and one on the other for a couple of days. So I've got, I think it's January 28th. You can see my exact activity level on all variables for that day. And it's interesting to see what one is what's recording and what the other is not recording.
Okay, I have two questions that I hope won't spoil your article. One is, do you have to pay for the data collection or anything like that? For example, Fitbit has a free website service that collects the data for you. There is a premium service if you want more information and all of that, but it's generally free once you buy the device itself.
Yeah, and the Basis health tracker, it's the same way. In fact, they don't have the premium tier that Fitbit has, so everything that you collect, as soon as you buy the device, you can get on the website. The only problem is that whereas Fitbit in the last 3 years has built up a rather robust ecosystem of allowing data to be shared to things like Microsoft Health Vault or MyFitnessPal, the Basis software is a very closed system. So there's no way to download your raw data. There's no way to share your data with other services yet. So it's, for a data geek, it's fun to look at, but if you wanted to actually analyze any of it, you would be transcribing it in some way versus getting, you know, like a CSV file or something of all your data.
Right. Okay. That was my second question, if you could get data out. Because with the Fitbit, with a free level of service, you cannot export the data. I assume you can if you pay for the premium service. And I should. I think I'm nearing 15 million steps on my Fitbit, so I should get it out.
Interesting. I know a lot of people who use Fitbit, but I've never talked to someone who's actually bought the premium. So
yeah,
I have no idea what you get with the premium. I've used the Fitbit. The Fitbit Force is, I guess, the fourth Fitbit that I've bought. I have the Fitbit One, the Fitbit Ultra, and the original Fitbit. So I really would think that after talking to a lot of people, someone would have bought that or said, hey, I paid for it. Or except if they don't want to admit that they pay, I think it's $49 a year or something like that.
It's not terribly expensive, but it is a chunk of change. I had the original Fitbit, and I also have the Fitbit Ultra, which is what I'm currently using. It is dinged, and the plastic is chipped off, but it still works. So I guess I guess now that we've paid for my daughter's spring tuition, maybe I should see if I have enough money to buy a Fitbit One to replace it. But in any case, sounds like you like this Basis B1 health tracker, $200. By comparison, how much is the Fitbit Force? That's kind of expensive too, right?
The Fitbit Force is $129.
Okay.
And the Fitbit Flex, which is also still available, is $99. And I think the Fitbit One is
$99. Probably $99. Yeah, that one I checked. So. But the wristband versions of these trackers seem to be a little bit more expensive for one reason or another. I'm not quite sure why. Maybe because it's more material. I don't know.
That could be it. And also, you bring up a point, I'm running out of wrist space. So I've kind of taken to wearing the Basis at night and maybe weekends. But during the week, I'm much more in love with my Pebble smartwatch for notifications and such. So the Basis sits at home during the week, and I wear it at night to get the sleep tracking data.
Now that's something I thought of. Now, I stopped wearing a watch when Microsoft discontinued its Spot service, which I still miss. But I will get a smartwatch eventually. I'm waiting to see what Apple releases. So that's a good point. You don't want to have like bangles on your wrist. I mean, I guess some people would.
Yeah, you only have so many wrists, and it's really hard to add new ones. And you know, replacing old ones is getting easier. But you know, you got two. And you bring up the Apple rumors of an iWatch or a smartwatch, and we do know, at least from the rumors this week, that there were a couple of things that came out that suggest it will build a health tracking component into it.
Yeah, apparently they're hiring healthcare or health sensor professionals from the medical field and that sort of thing.
There was also some leak yesterday I saw about an iOS 8 teaser that there would be an app that would kind of collect data from the M7 processor in the phone as well as data from the watch and do data analysis for health tracking on that. Right. So and we shall see what happens this year.
Right. In fact, the iPhone 5S, but not the 5C, has the M processor, the motion processor. And I believe the latest Fitbit app update for the iPhone actually can read that information. So I found that kind of interesting. You know, Fitbit makes its money from hardware. They're like Apple. They're essentially a hardware company. So the fact that they're enabling the use of the M processor in the iPhone, which means you don't have to buy a Fitbit, makes me wonder where Fitbit sees itself going, if it's going to become, you know, like Microsoft, if they're going to start calling themselves a devices and services company or something.
Well, with the robust ecosystem they've built, where I think Fitbit, when I compare all the trackers, Fitbit is the one that can sync or send their data to the most places. It wouldn't surprise me if they see the writing on the wall that one day the phone you carry will be able to do everything their tracker does, and so at that point switch over to a services architecture where you might pay $2 or $3 a month, or you might buy an app, and it would just sync all your data to a Fitbit account.
All right. Okay, so the final thing this week is my app of the week. Which will be familiar to Android users, but brand new to iPhone and iPad users. And that's SwiftKey Note for iOS. SwiftKey is SwiftKey Note for iOS. Currently, it only works with Evernote. And that is to say, you can use gesture writing, for people familiar with that on the Android side of the world, where you move your finger through a virtual on-screen keyboard, and it does a very good job of guessing what it is you're trying, what word you're trying to type based on where you're swiping your keys around on. And in fact, Nuance has a product called Swype, S-W-Y-P-E, that is similar. Google itself has a gesture recognition system for their Android phones, but really, because of iOS's sandboxing, you can't have a general purpose one that works across everything like you do in Android. There have been a couple of gesture apps for the iPhone in the past, but this one works with one of my favorite apps, Evernote. So I'm looking for, I installed it, haven't played with it that much, but it's my app of the week only because I like SwiftKey on Android, I like Evernote on everything. And hopefully it'll work well for me as a gesture input. Speaking of which, Evernote had a couple of updates, and they've also had a couple of criticisms about their quality of software, which I have to agree with. They've kind of gotten downhill. Hopefully, they're getting their act together in that. That's at least what Phil Leiben, its CEO, responded to a blogger who complained bitterly about their software quality and problems that were caused by it. But anyway, SwiftKey Note for iOS. It's free. Works with Evernote. I recommend taking a look at it.
My only question is, so I'm reading the description. It says Evernote Sync. It'll sync with Evernote. Mm-hmm. But there's also a share button in one of the screenshots. What does that allow you to share out to?
I think it puts it out. It's like a copy-paste thing.
Okay.
Yeah, it doesn't integrate with Evernote. I should make that clear. It's a self-contained app, and it can write notes to Evernote's database.
All right. Well, that sounds... It would be great if we had a few more options for text input on iOS, so I might have to check this out.
Yeah, that's, you know, I like iOS, but one of the reasons I also use Android is because Android is a little bit more open. It's sort of like, I guess I'm not sure what a good comparison would be, but it's sort of like what Windows Mobile was when it was good. You know, and Windows Phone is more like iOS than Windows Mobile was, and Windows Mobile or Android is more like Windows Mobile, which is kind of ironic, I think.
Back in the glory days.
Yeah, I miss Windows Mobile. Windows Mobile.
Well, okay. Who knows? We could see Android go more sandboxy, especially with the change from Dalvik to Ant and other things happening with that platform. And who knows? Apple at some point. They've opened things up in the last year, at least in terms of... you know, multitasking and things like that with iOS 7 that we hadn't expected from them. So maybe there'll be an evolution of both platforms toward one or the other direction.
Indeed. Well, in any case, this brings us to the end of MobileView's podcast number 73 with my friend John Westfall. This has been Todd Ogasawara. Hope you enjoyed it, and we'll talk to you next time.